You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Thomas Edison summed up his creative approach. Genius, he said, is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. The problem is, how can we find that elusive 1%? Dan Crow and Philip Alterman surveyed more than 60 authors to find out what inspires them and then published the responses in a new book from Rizzoli called How I Write, The Secret Lives of Writers. I'm very pleased that it has brought Dan Crow and two of the contributors to the book, Siri Husvedt and Nicole Krauss, to my show today. It's a pleasure to see you all, and welcome two of you back.
Thank you.
Dan, did this book come out of the 1% or the 99% of your creative impulses?
Oh, gosh. Well, I guess it came from the fact that I used to have dreams of being a writer. And for many years, I wrote short stories and tried to write a book. But then I realized that what I really lacked was talent. And I was brave enough to go off in another direction. But one thing I was aware of is how I loved my desk and my pens and my paper and the view, and in other words, how I loved to procrastinate. And it was to do with the sort of aesthetics of writing without actually doing any writing that I seemed to be quite good at. So I wanted to know if other writers had that.
Did you do any research into the unusual habits of famous authors of the past?
A lot of my favorite authors have habits or systems that they would sort of kick into. I mean, you know, Flaubert couldn't write without his lover's mittens in his drawer. And that's a lovely sign of his generous character. I think to get too obsessed.
Schiller, I understand, had a box of apples that he kept in a closet, and he had to sniff it before he started working. And Hemingway needed every pencil sharpened before he could start.
Right.
So I guess these are the rituals. I don't think every writer has those rituals, do they? Or is that what you discovered when you sent out
your letters? I think that's
true.
I mean, there's different types of ritual. There's different types of talismans. Some are necessary. Some, like series or Nicole's, are things that they like to have around, perhaps, but that means something or act as a springboard, perhaps. Some writers absolutely need certain things, like Douglas Copeland needs chocolate, no writing.
Well, that can be bad for the teeth and for the stomach.
Bad for everything apart from the writing, yeah.
So how did you wind up choosing the group of authors you invited to contribute to the book? Some are famous, some are less famous, and one of them is unpublished, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, she's published now in a couple of magazines. Well, they're just writers that I like, admire. I like their work. I'm just trying to think if there's any exceptions there.
Well, obviously not the two who are in the room with us.
Yeah, I mean,
I can't.
Yeah, right. No, I'll be pretty honest about this. No, I asked about 130 authors, all of whom I had great admiration for or have, and 78 got back. About four of them said absolutely not. This idea is retrograde. And I said, well, that's great for you to say that. And the rest just couldn't get it in time because they kept on getting Nobel Prizes, things like that.
Well, what did you ask them to do?
What was it? Well, the idea is, I mean, I sent quite a long letter, but the idea is for them to send a picture and some writing of a thing or a feeling that somehow helps them writing. And it could be an abstract, it could be an object or something, or just an experience that helps them keep going.
Nicole, what did you think when you received Dan's letter?
I guess my first reaction was that I sort of hate the idea of inspiration, or it makes me feel uneasy, or ritual. Somehow I want to think of writing as an incredibly workmanlike thing, a profession like any other, where you simply, what you're doing is you're putting words behind other words, and then at the end of that you have a paragraph and then a book. But the truth of the matter is that throughout my life I've had lots of small and big things which have made it possible for me to write, and that writing is very often a struggle for me, and that I have to find ways of almost tricking myself to make it possible. Mm-hmm. And then very quickly I had a list of 10 or 12 things that I could have written about.
Because these are the sorts of things writers do think about in their spare time, aren't they? Is that what happened with you, Siri?
Well, actually, I think we went back and forth a little bit, Dan and I, and I chose something kind of odd, and it was simply this. After my father died, we were going through his papers and study, and I found in a little metal box, a little green metal box, I opened it up, and there were 7 keys to which my father had attached a small label that said, "Unknown Keys." Now, this is a sign of my father's intensely organized person, so it
but
was
it would
funny,
inspire a metaphorically
but it did because I started
person.
It became mysterious, you know, the man was dead, here were these unknown keys, and suddenly I thought, well, this is in some way parallel to the process of writing, because I always feel that I'm trying to unlock what I don't know and opening doors that were not there before. So it became a kind of mysterious metaphor for the process of
it's
writing.
It's almost like trust, isn't it? These talismans, these objects, they're nothing apart from faith, maybe.
And in your case, Nicole, there was a photograph?
Yeah, actually, ultimately, the piece that I wrote was about two things. One is a photograph that I found in a flea market some years ago that's of two parachuters. It's taken from the plane out of which they've just jumped, and you see them just descending to this snowy landscape. And I think it always reminds me of writing at its best, which is for me a kind of exhilaration, a kind of freedom, really. That when I'm really loving what I do, it's because I'm exercising my freedom in the greatest possible way. Both in I'm able to say things I might not be able to say in my life, but I'm able to, I guess at its best, reinvent the world.
My guests are Nicole Krauss and Siri Husbett, two writers, two contributors to a book called How I Write, The Secret Lives of Writers from Rizzoli, which is edited by Dan Crow and Philip Alterman, and Dan Crow is here. And interestingly, Dan, most of the writers you contacted were Americans.
A lot of them were American. The publisher of the book is obviously based in America, Rizzoli, and they were very keen for there to be a lot of American authors in there. I mean, again, these are authors that you know, that are my heroes and that I love and you know, I'm very fond of, so that's why I asked them. But you know, there's also 20 or so British authors.
But it's interesting that you ask people about objects that provided inspiration, because somebody else might have written a very different kind of request letter, don't you think?
Mm.
Well, the letter was slightly complicated because it had to convey the fact that I wanted something, or if you didn't have something, then I don't want something. I want nothing, but the nothing you have to send me. So if you wanted to send me a blank piece of paper, that's just fine. And that's not necessarily an easy thing to convey. One of the authors got back to me and said, well, look, this is fine, but what's the fee? And I said, well, because there's so many authors in the book, I'm going to have to give you a gift. I gave a tailor-made gift to each author. So this author wrote back saying, well, look, you know, that's not good enough, but if you want a one-word contribution, you can have it. Money. And that's in the book. I used that.
You used it.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, you know, he gave me an honest answer. And
some writers described inspiration from utilitarian objects. Jonathan Franzen cited his office chair, for example, and others chose objects that are symbolic or even talismanic. Can we read anything into these choices, do you think?
I think what the book is basically saying is what Nicole just said there, which is, in a way, writing is working in the way that perhaps Pollock was making paintings. He was working, and it's a very fine line between something, being creatively being successful and not. And these are things that help writers focus and go through various systems, that whether it's a squeaky chair for Jonathan Franzen. I mean, Jonathan got back to me and said, I don't have anything. And I said, I just can't believe that. I mean, you know, there must be something. He said, no, I go to the same office every day. I have this squeaky chair. And I said, well, that, you know,
that
have you ever written on any other chair? And he said, well, no.
Well, I think it is interesting, actually, that you asked about objects, because I think at the moment when writing is really working is when you forget your physical surroundings. And you know you're really writing well when you look at the clock and an hour has passed, and you suddenly I've written a page, I've written whatever. And so the best objects, in a sense, are those that you can forget.
Yeah.
But
right.
Both you and Siri chose symbolic objects, and I wonder if you see that as saying something about the kind of writer you are.
You know, I think that the process of writing is deeply mysterious. And, of course, the fact it's partly deeply mysterious simply because the mind is mysterious. The mind-brain is something we don't fully understand. But you are entering into territory that is mysterious. Mm. And I, for example, always need to have places to sort of locate my characters or whatever is happening in the story. I need to locate them somewhere. And I just read that there was a study of people who have bilateral hippocampal damage, which is very important to memory. And they found out that they have a hard time imagining spaces, not just remembering real spaces, but if they say, imagine being in a marketplace somewhere in the Far East, they have much more impoverished memories. So that the imagination and remembering are connected.
Right. Mm.
I find that really fascinating and mysterious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do
but
we invent these stories?
Both of those things
stories?
Are, when you're looking into the past, the past doesn't really exist apart from memory.
No.
Perhaps.
No,
and that's very
not.
Similar to fiction. And fiction doesn't exist unless it's in memory. Oh, I don't know.
And yeah, right. I don't know about you, Siri, but my memory works just as well when I'm in an empty room than a room filled with objects from my life. I mean,
yes.
And sometimes my memory probably is, in a way, more alive when I'm totally alone in an empty room. I mean, the office that I'm working in right now, although it's changed many times in the last few months, is in a concrete room in Gowanus.
Right.
And the only thing that's in there is a desk and a chair.
Right.
And I'm probably working better than I have been for months.
And so that's outside of your home.
In the photograph, the photograph isn't with me.
Is that important for you to work outside of your
home?
Yeah,
but for mundane reasons, I have a child, et cetera, life intrudes.
Yes.
And there is something to be said for simply having a room of one's own.
Do you also work in an isolated situation, Siri? Because I always wonder about these people who work on their laptops
at
the coffee shop.
No, that I couldn't do. I work in a nice study at the top of the house. And actually, this is another thing about writing, and we're talking about sort of talismans and objects, but I think that there's a hugely important motor component to writing as well. In other words, that if you are stuck, almost every writer knows that if you stand up and walk across the room, go to the bathroom, or in my case, fold laundry, that suddenly these physical motions seem to be connected to the motion of the sentence. Mm. And, that too is very interesting.
It's absolutely true. It's the reason, for example, that people often are tapping their foot when they're trying to write.
But
just something needs to be moving in order to allow the brain to be slightly preoccupied.
Or the cliche of the pacing author.
Absolutely, and I think it was Mandelstam, the great Russian poet, who said, I wonder how many sandals Dante wore out when he was writing the Divine Comedy, mm-hmm. because there's this feeling, I mean, writing and walking are connected in some way.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
I think Dan Brown jumps to the floor every sort of chapter and does some sit-ups. I don't know if that means
I always thought he just opened up a door and said, and what was on the other side of the door? What about writing on the road? Is it more difficult if you are in a hotel room? Or I know one writer who tells me he goes off to an isolated old grand colonial hotel in Indonesia. I think it is. Thailand, because nobody knows him, and that's where he can complete a book.
Yeah.
I think for me, when I was younger, I used to sort of fetishize the idea that everything had to be an exact way before you could sit down to write, and that writers' houses, writers' rooms, writers' decks, all of those things somehow were a romantic idea to me. But as I've gotten older, I've grown to sort of love the idea of being somebody who can simply write anywhere, and I began to really pride myself on that yes, I could be in a hotel room and write just as well as if I were at my own office.
My guests are Nicole Krauss and Siri Husvet, among the contributors to a book called How I Write, The Secret Lives of Authors, which also includes people like Joyce Carol Oates, Rick Moody, Jonathan Franzen, A.S. Byatt, and our other writer guests, Siri Husvet. The editors are Dan Crow and Philip Alterman, and Dan Crow is with us. We will continue our conversation after this. My guests are Dan Crow, editor of How I Write, The Secret Lives of Authors, and two of the authors included in the book, the Park Slope Contingent, Siri Husvet and Nicole Krauss. This book has a wide array of writers, including a fair number who've been on the show: Nicholson, Baker, Melissa Bank, Anthony Bourdain, Alain de Botton. That's A.S. Byatt. We're just up to B there.
Yeah.
So Neil Labute is here as well, even though he really doesn't write novels. It was important for you just to find people who write?
No. there's a lot of writers that I didn't. Basically, I wanted to reduce the remit to fiction, people that write fiction. And Neil Labute, I suppose, could be one of those writers. The only exception to that is Janine DiGiovanni, the war correspondent and a journalist. But she, in fact, does write fiction. She just doesn't publish it.
Mm. Now, let's get back to we were in a room, and that was good but not necessary for both of you. What about certain times of year or certain times of the day?
I like light, I realize, that light has some kind of effect on my body when I'm writing. And that, you know, darkness is probably creates a certain kind of melancholy that might not be good for me. I like to have the light coming through.
But because not like sun on you.
Well, just into a room so that there's a kind of light. And I know that this affects me. And Nicole was talking earlier about jiggling legs. I think this is another interesting thing to look at what people do when they write, the way they sit. Sometimes I find myself rocking. And that is clearly has to do with the rhythms that you're trying to get into the sentences that are part of your, you know, physical person.
Yeah, I have a terrible habit, I'm terrible for my posture, of writing with usually one or occasionally even both legs up on the chair, which it makes it both hard to reach the keyboard and afterwards is incredibly painful. But I just can't, I'm addicted.
I wonder if Joseph Conrad rocked differently than Ernest Hemingway based on the length of their sentences.
I would say definitely. I said we could make a bet on that, yeah.
And there are writers who prefer to work in the dark. There are writers who get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and write into the early morning and then stop when everybody else starts waking. So there, I don't know about you, Nicole. I assume as a young mother, you're also.
I do it when I can. I also write in the morning, which has always been the case, even before I was a mother. And I think, you know, I'm just at a certain point, my brain is just no longer as awake and active and hopefully intelligent as it once was.
I agree. I believe deeply in the morning brain and that after a certain number of hours, I feel it slipping. Mm-hmm. It is as if I know that it's getting turned off.
But it slips and it keeps on slipping and that's where we get into the nighttime writing. It keeps on slipping and it goes down and it goes down and the people that write at night are the people that are way down there and their writing is typically more dark and concerned with the desperation of the human condition.
No, not true at all. The rest of us are flowers. But you
articulate that certainly, but you yourselves are not desperate, I would say.
I don't know. I've always
I've written some dark stuff.
Dark.
But as people, you like light.
Yes, but I think what Nicole and I are talking about is something really physiological, yeah. And that is simply this: that after a certain number of hours, you know, whatever has been on those neuronal circuits have been cooked to a degree where I feel I can sense that the sentence I wrote right after that moment is
yeah, but you know, but does it stop? Because if I've only written one novel, and nobody will ever read it. But what I remember is that even when I quit writing for a day, the characters continued to talk my head, and I'd go to supermarket, and there they'd be talking, driving me crazy. I'd have to stop and write little things down.
Right.
It just didn't end for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. No, I think I always go to sleep with the characters talking. Mm-hmm. And
very often the most genius scenes come to you in the middle of the night. Of course, you don't write them then, and then you don't remember them. Or if you do remember them, they turn out to be totally foolish.
Exactly. You think that they're brilliant,
yeah.
Or that you dream something, and then you say, this is wonderful. And then when you look at
the
your notes in the morning,
in the hard light of day,
pure nonsense.
So you've gone into this space, your workspace. Do you immediately start writing? Do you wait for some light bulb to go off? Do you look at what you wrote yesterday and think, okay, where do I pick up from there?
Yeah, it's somehow comforting to remind oneself that one has been able to write a sentence once upon a time. And so I usually start, for a long time when I'm writing a novel, I start at the beginning of the novel and read all the way through what I've written.
Oh, boy, that must get rough when you're 300, 400 pages into it.
At a certain point, it becomes impossible. But somehow I find that comforting. It's a way in.
Yeah, I go back to the day before, or possibly a couple of days before, read through it to feel the push of what I'm doing, and then start. And I start pretty quickly. I don't have elaborate rituals or straightening.
Do you have goals, a certain number of pages?
No. What I call it is a beat. The book I'm writing now is organized into beats. It's kind of fragments, and I think of the book as being organized as a beat. So you could have a beat that's a paragraph or three pages or even longer. And if I accomplish a beat in one day, then I feel very happy.
That's great.
I'm incredibly disciplined about working every day, but I'm incredibly undisciplined within that, which is to say that I'll go to wherever it is that my computer is and I'll sit down, but I'm sort of okay with whatever might or might not happen there on a given day. Somehow or other, the book needs to get done, but I'm not really concerned with measuring hourly or daily.
And there are never panic moments where you think, there have been 4 days where I haven't had a beat.
Or you spend 4 days and then you realize that it's crap and you toss it out. In my case, that happens with a certain regularity.
I think, you know.
Is that easy to do that? I mean, to really delete or at least put it away?
You feel it's bad, it's, you know,
in a way,
sparing
that's
yourself.
The thing I like to do the most is to throw things away. Really, it's sort of very satisfying to throw out the junk.
That's rigorous.
Of course, in the old movies, people would type about 4 lines and then they would pull it out of the typewriter angrily, crumple it, throw the garbage.
It's a completely misleading image, because actually, I think that very, very rarely happens when someone goes, "Okay, I've got no ideas on my head, but I'm going to sit down in front of this typewriter and go. Here we go." No, people have a story that they want to try and articulate, right? You don't just sit down with nothing in your head.
Oh, I do.
Really?
Very often.
But when you find out what you want to write about?
In a certain way, my real thinking comes only through writing. And very, very often I have no idea what it is that I want to write about or even what I'm thinking about. Well, I'm thinking about nothing at that moment. And writing is a kind of a way to push the thought into existence.
But a book is so long. So don't you have some vague idea,
absolutely,
at least, that begins?
Right, I guess because, you're at the end of a novel and I'm at the beginning, so we're thinking in two different ends.
Yes.
So yes, at the end I absolutely have things that are, at the end point you walk around the city or your house and every single thing you do is a thought that is laboring for the book, and everything you see and read about somehow goes into the larger picture that is always clear in your mind of what's going on in the book. But I think at the beginning for me there's a whole lot of nothing, and there's a long time which I have to force myself against the nothing until there's something.
That's why I stopped, and not only for lack of talent, but it was beginning to annoy me that I was sitting down enjoying writing but not having anything to write about, and I decided that was the sign that I wasn't a writer, and I think I made the right decision. But I know it's very disturbing sitting down thinking, right, okay, how is this going to start? Are they
the book that I'm writing now, I actually took some time just to meditate. I didn't write anything. I had some images, some very strange, unconscious images. The first one was a girl sitting up from her coffin. And then I just played with this, and the people began to come. And I did that for quite a while before I started writing. I just dreamed.
Wow. And your books take longer than the...
Yes, I'm really slow.
My guests are Dan Crowe, who is the editor of a new book called How I Write, The Secret Lives of Authors, published by Rizzoli. And I guess we should have expected a book from Rizzoli to also be beautiful, because it is quite lovely to look at, as well as interesting to read. And two of the authors who have contributed, Siri Husvet and Nicole Krauss. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. A listener wants to know if you've ever compared your experiences with painters that you know. Do they talk about having similar things happen to them when they face that empty canvas, or they come back to a canvas after having worked on it for a few days?
I think it's really quite similar. I know a number of painters who have, you know, fear in the studio, number one, and little rituals that they complete before they go to work. And I think it's, even though obviously we're talking about, you know, verbal as opposed to images, I think that the processes are involving many of the same parts of us.
Mm-hmm. Well, I always made sure that my brushes were clean before I started working.
Always good.
Did your sources of inspiration change once you were published? People say that the first novels have to be written and the rest are expected to be written. Has that been your experience?
Mm. I've definitely found that there's something incredibly helpful about working in opposition to something. So before you're ever published, you're sort of working in opposition to the idea that you can't be a writer or that nobody considers you one. And then after you're published, at least for me, there was a crisis of sort of reevaluation, having to redefine what that opposition might be, because I needed something. I talked about the idea of pushing against. Mm-hmm. Well, that's incredibly important to me in my sense of how I work. And so I think in a way, yes, things changed for me, but it's just the opposition has changed, what my idea of that opposition is.
Do you know what do you have an opposition now?
I do, but can I keep it to myself?
Sure.
Oh, that's interesting about opposition. I think that all my books are written out of a kind of necessity. I have to do it. And I couldn't write a book that I didn't have to write. And that's where the urgency comes from. And I often feel that when I'm writing badly, it's because for some reason I'm lying to myself about the truth of the book, or that urgency is for some reason missing.
Well, I think that's exactly it, that often, and I mean to answer your question in a kind of abstract way, the idea of opposition for me I think has much to do with myself at this point.
Right.
Certain failures that I worry about having as a writer, or certain habits that I have that I'd like to change, or just simply a sense of not wanting to do what I've done before.
So it's a dialectical experience. You have the one thing, and then you try to do something that's opposite to
exactly.
it.
Exactly. I mean, it's like
no one wants to write the same book.
So many people do.
Yes, but you also find out almost against one's own will that there are certain obsessions that keep returning, that you simply can't get out of it. I mean, and that's probably the little fingerprint of a writer.
It's your character.
Obsessions, yeah.
If you Google the words writing and inspiration, it gives you 30.8 million hits. but the phrase writer's block only gets 1.6 million hits. So is it more productive to look for inspiration than it is to dwell on the problem? Is that what you discovered these writers?
I think you can't really look for inspiration. You can do things that you know will help, which is, Sirius said, is partly physiological. You can go for a shower or a walk. These things are going to do good and not bad. David Guterson needs his lights, his Bud Light and his Marlboro Light, to help. But you can't expect
alcohol and cigarettes have fueled an awful lot of
writers. That's Tony D'Souza.
Yes.
Needs that. David Guterson likes to drive at night. Unfortunately, inspiration is almost, I think, nothing to do with it. Just happens, doesn't it? It occurs, and you don't know when. You can't expect to get it if you go to the zoo.
It happens in the language itself. When you accidentally stumble on a word or a sentence or a way of saying something that you've always felt but never quite been able to push into words, and it happens, and then suddenly that gives birth to another idea and another sentence.
Well, what about editing your book?
Yeah.
Is it more difficult than the first draft? The first draft, when all of these things come to you, the second one where you try to figure out
I think you use a different part of your mind, you know, because you're, first of all, you have this distance from the text, which is what you need when you're editing very badly, to go over the sentences, to listen to the music, and, you know, make sure that the rhythms are there the way you wanted them to be there, you know, that you don't use the same word. You know, it's this kind of editorial brain that takes over.
But then also, I'm assuming, suddenly a light bulb goes off or the equivalent, and you realize that this is not working, and a whole other thing has to be written, and you're back to first draft.
Exactly, and then you have to go back or to that section and redo it, and then you have to return to this non-editorial creative self to make it come
out. Writers, actually, I used to ask from a magazine called Butterfly, I used to edit writers to review their own books. So if the writer's reviewing their own book, that means that their book has come out, which means they've stopped writing it 12 months prior to that, mm-hmm. which means that mm-hmm. they are objective and consequently very good critics.
Well, things have changed over the last 30 or maybe 50 years, where people are much more split-brained than they were in an earlier time, and kids do their homework to music, mm-hmm. watching television at the same time. Do you think that's happened to young writers as well?
To young writers?
Yeah. Did anyone tell you, I have to have music on at the same time? I have to have the television on at the same time?
I think probably because of the opulence of the media now. I mean, but certain writers do need certain types of music. Michelle Faber always likes to listen to German punk, retro electronic punk when he's writing his Victorian romances. He needs music that doesn't chime with the book he's writing.
Wow.
He needs music that separates his surroundings
really
with his book.
Interesting, because I just cannot listen to any music.
It's too much of a distraction.
Absolutely. Yeah. It disturbs the rhythms.
I always wish that I could. That's what I envy about painters. We were talking about that. That they can actually
listen
to music.
Yeah.
Now, Siri and Nicole, you're both married to authors. Do your writing routines differ from your husband's, or do you all go off at the same time and tend to come back for lunch?
Right. Well, in our case, Paul has a studio away from our house, so we're both work alone in a space. And he does have he's very attached to a certain kind of notebook. He's very attached to his fountain pen, and he has a very old typewriter that he got used in the 70s, a manual typewriter that he still uses. And that is, I think, a kind of fetish object for him. There's no question about it. All his books have been written on it, and he doesn't want to let that guy go.
In my case, I mean, when you have a young child, you have, in a certain way, very little choice about how you work, when you work, etc. And I started off in this interview talking about the idea of sort of workmanship and liking to think of writing not so much as this sort of ethereal thing, but as a real hard profession. And I think in both my case and Jonathan's, that's sort of how we think of it. We both go off to work in the morning with our coffee, always to separate places. Those places are always changing depending on what's possible on that given day. The library, an office in Gowanus, wherever. And we just try to get it done.
Do you have any suggestions as to how to procrastinate while you're writing?
Well, I know Paul used to play solitaire before.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was a way of working himself into it, getting closer and closer to it. I think maybe because I am a mother myself, that those writing hours were always so precious to me, especially when my daughter was younger. She's now a grown-up. That I would just sit down, click on the writing person, and then when I had to stop, which was often before to pick her up at school, I would stop. Mm. So I got very efficient about those hours, workmanlike, as Nicole was saying.
I suppose my real weakness is other books. I mean, if they're on my desk, I'll read them. So I have to sort of, I keep some of my favorites there, my favorites on that given month. And I often sort of read a paragraph or a page and sometimes lose track of time and realize I've read way too much and written way too little.
But there is something happens, you talk about being in opposition. To some degree, the reading actually gives you another kind of opposition, doesn't it?
It
used to like to write, when I was writing, I used to love to read writers who were nothing like me.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I read after I mean, now, speaking of children, my daughter does not live at home. So when I finish writing, my brain is burned, then I read. I often read for about 3 hours. And I read a lot of science and nonfiction. But the reading does feed you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to leave it there. You've fed our audience a lot of ideas. We've been talking about a book called How I Write, The Secret Lives of Writers, with two of the contributors, Siri Husvedt and Nicole Krauss. The other contributors are a wide range, including some of the most recognizable names in literature today. And the book was put together by Dan Crowe and Philip Alterman, and Dan Crowe is the editor. It is published by Rizzoli. Thank you all for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.